Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. Today we have an exciting guest for you. It is Oka from Crypto Rogue Games. So he's working on Web3 gaming. It's very interesting and exciting. We're going to have a good opportunity to see some of the visuals in the YouTube version of the show. So excited to have Oka here. Welcome to the show.
Hey, buddy. Hey, Miko. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the first big question is, maybe you can tell us a bit about the game you're working on. So sure. Give me a sense of what the project is.
So we're building an old school isometric action RPG game for the PC platform. So a game called Crystal Near Moons. So that is a steampunk themed game. It's pretty much following like the OG footstep of Diablo 2 and some of the exciting mechanics from Path of Exile. So it's been an exciting project I've been working on for 2 years, and yeah, looking for some early beta in 2024, basically.
That's terrific. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why I really was excited to have you on the show is that you're an OG gamer. You have quite a rich background in this, and you know, I'd love to have you explain a bit about your sort of story, you know, going all the way back. So tell me a bit about kind of how you got here, and you know, how it came to be that you are working on this game.
Sure. If we rewind like really long back in when you had during the 90s,
yep.
I mean, as I was a kid, I was, you know, the first computer I had, like, if you look at back in the 80s, was the Commodore 64. And then, you know, I remember, like, the first game we were playing as kids, what was it back then, like, 6-7 years. It was literally, like, I remember the first game I ever played was this. It was a keyboard on the TV, and let's say the bottom K lighted up, and then you're just going to hit the K button on the keyboard, and it was the reaction time. And it was mesmerizing. We spent nights and nights playing that game, right?
Wow.
And so, like, I grew up with computers. I had a fortune to be part of that era when you didn't have proper internet at your home. And I say fortunate because it gave us an opportunity to meet other people when you had this, like, computer clubs and LAN parties. And that was a special time. So, like, growing up, seeing all of these new games and new mechanics that had never been seen before and being mesmerized by this, I mean, that was amazing time. It was a really, really amazing time. And I remember, like, for me, it was just the first time I ever played Dune 2, which was the real-time strategy game by Westwood Studios. It was Dune 2000. Was by Lewis Castle and his team. That was, like, mind-blowing for me. That later became Command & Conquer and was just something I kept on with. And then, you know, Diablo 1 came. I mean, we're talking about, yeah. I was a teenager. And that was something that was also, like, new. I mean, remember, like, this was December 1996, Diablo came, such an amazing game, and I think it changed a generation of us truly fans of action RPG games. So what me and my friends did is, like, we actually had the first web page in the world that was selling items for Diablo on eBay.
Amazing.
So that is, like, really way, way back, right? So I kept, you know, consuming games. Later in life, I started. I was playing StarCraft professionally here in Europe. Could never beat the Asians. They were, like, too skilled, too high APM.
Yeah, Korean guys.
Yeah, like, but this was, yes. like old, like, StarCraft 1 and Brood Wars, yep. Where APM actually meant something. And, yeah. Like, if you look at the old videos of World Cyber Games at the Koreans back then, it's like they were, like, out of this world. Like, it was amazing times.
Yeah, those people can click a mouse. Like, that's definitely like ridiculous.
For sure. No, and that kind of later led into I became like a professional poker player. There's actually a lot of StarCraft players that became professional poker player.
Wow.
If you look at like in the Web3 sphere, like that's how like Brian, the founder of Layer0, you know, old poker player as well. There's actually a lot of poker players that's been playing poker are now, you know, in the Web3 space.
Like also on the investor side, by the way.
Oh yeah.
Right. So there's a bunch of them, like Haseeb at Dragonfly. Also Evan from my team, he's a poker player. So there's definitely plenty. And there's kind of Bitcoin poker, so there's a lot of people. Nah. You know, so Pantera guys, like there's a lot of poker out there.
Yes. And then, you know, that sparked the interest of understanding like how the business side was going on, like you know, ran affiliation for this industry and started to launch my own sites and my own game studios, and so like, but we still had this core team of working with games that we grew up with, and we were like a team of five guys that started with this, you know, trading items online. So we kept on doing that for 15 years, right? This was way before blockchain and, you know, marketplace and all these things. But it's a rough market, right? There's a lot of scams that happen there. It's like, let's be honest.
Sure.
And then some of us had more fortune than other. One of my friends, he was the founder of Grindr Games and the game Path of Exile. But we always kept in touch. And then I think we were interested in bit like this thing called Bitcoin. I think it's like I was back in 2014. Some of my friends, they still have, you know, BTC locked in at Mt. Gox. And this is just like I started looking at these things like, oh, this is really interesting. This is this can potentially be something. I was never smart enough to invest back then, obviously.
So just a quick note, right? Mt. Gox, as everyone knows, is sort of the Magic the Gathering online exchange. So I just wanted to kind of spotlight for the audience kind of the connections between both Magic as well as poker into Bitcoin, right? So there's lots of intersections between gamers and kind of Bitcoin, you know. So I think this is definitely the earliest days of the dawning of this phenomenon. So absolutely, please continue.
And I love this that you said the Magic Gathering. How much time and how much money did like I spend on that particular card game? I mean, oh my God.
For sure, for sure. And so I think to me, when you think about the exchange and the mechanism of exchange, Mt. Gox was super logical because people were already investing in cards and they were already investing substantially in cards, right? So the evolution of a purely digital online medium or a currency, you know, became very logical as an intersection to, you know, these already, you know, in a sense, these are kind of like NFTs, or I mean, they're basically these assets that you can buy, you know, and having a currency for that is, it's all fits together. So anyhow, please continue.
Now, so, and I think that we've launched several companies. I've launched several companies. And, you know, this, we're talking about my first company was like when I was young, 20. That was like with the affiliation, for online gambling. I've been in gambling, fintech, and secondary market trading for games and to running studios, right? But I think like I don't remember like is it like rough? I think it's like 14 companies that like launched and like badly crashed and burned with like 9 of them, and I think that is the one of like when I speak to young entrepreneurs. Like sometimes I get asked, like, can't you come and talk to you about your success to other young entrepreneurs? Like, no, I'm not interested whatsoever to speak about my success. I'd rather speak about all my failures. Because when you're young, please go ahead and fail. That is completely fine. It's actually an awesome thing to learn to do because you learn so much. And I have this philosophy that, you know, your success is a byproduct of your past failures, you know, by not doing you know, made you fail in the past, you automatically position yourself to have an opportunity to be more successful. And that, so sometimes it feels like those things that have gone well in my life has been like a byproduct of all of these things, that, you know, the learning. I wish that the the 22-year-old Åke knew what the 43-year-old Åke knows today, right? So all of this then later in life, I stepped down from as a CEO of one of my studios, and this was back during the pandemic. And like all of my some of my like old childhood friends that we started this journey together as entrepreneurs, we were scattered across like the world. Some was in Colombia, some was in New Zealand, some was in Malta, and so on. And it's like, okay, here's actually an opportunity, because we're from Northern Sweden. We're based here in Northern Sweden, Umeå. And I think a lot of people during the pandemic was like, let's go back to our roots, you know, the families, and everybody was moving back. And during that time, we kind of like, okay, we have been we've looked at blockchain. We've seen how things are this technology, this phenomenon of what's going on. This was like in 2020. But we also realized that there was like a lot of things that was going wrong in this industry. And the way that we looked at it is that it was like an opportunity to disrupt the market, actually to disrupt the Web3, I would say. To disrupt Web3 that would ripple down into Web2 by building something that we knew how to build, which was action RPG games. So this is something that we then started in 2021, getting the team together. The only difference now, back when we were like in our young 20s, is like now we have like 20 years of experience, and we are able to set together like create like this dream team with our unique experience from this, like, that you actually need to navigate a company and to run a company in Web3 and building games. So
so I would love to get your perspective on kind of Web3, right? Because obviously to me, your experience of like the first eBay store for kind of in-game digital assets within the Diablo 2 world, these kinds of like experiences, you've always been, you know, with poker, with Magic the Gathering, like you've always had this kind of economic adjacency, right? Whereas a player, you've kind of been playing kind of with money, right? But I think it's kind of interesting to try to understand your perspective on Web3, because like, how do you see this in the bigger picture affecting potentially all gamers?
There's multiple angles that I'm looking at Web3.
Yep.
So I think we need to dissect them one by one.
Sure, sure.
I would say that, to give you some background, 2000, Diablo 2 was launched, right? And 2012, Diablo 3 was launched. And so there's like a huge gap there. And during that time, I remember my friends at Grinding Gear Games. There was a bunch of friends that got together to build that game, and what they looked at is that Path of Exile was actually saw this opportunity, and then was, well, okay, the idea was first to launch it before Diablo 3, obviously, but it came out after. What was different here is that Path of Exile were free to play. And most games back then on Steam was not free to play, right? Like I would say that Eric, Chris, and Jonathan basically launched one of the first really like, you know, decent free to play games on Steam. And
amazing.
And I remember the conversation back then was like they couldn't get any media publicity, they couldn't get any publisher. Nobody wanted to touch the can of worm that free to play was. And I admire Chris and Jonathan and Eric's vision.
Free to play made people angry, actually, right? Free to play was like, free to play is going to ruin gaming. The industry will be destroyed. Like, free to play is toxic, it's terrible, and no one should ever do it.
100%.
That was what it was like, 100%. Just to remind people.
But I admire their guts and their vision, and they just saw this as a different business model. And it's a different way to monetize it. And it's a slightly different audience. But at the end of the day, I admire them for doing that and sticking to their belief, which can be sometimes very daunting. And that is how we see blockchain and Web3. We see that as a different business model. We don't think that every game right now, like, I don't think every game should be Web3. Like,
Sure.
yes, and as much as not every game needs to be or should be free to play, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And then, so that is that from a business stand, a business model standpoint. And then when it comes to, if the question also relies into like where we are right now with Web3, there's been a lot of focus in the past on how we can scale and how many transaction per second, like all this nerdy stuff.
Sure.
Like ask any like woman or man, boy or girl that's playing on let's say Diablo 4. We have Diablo 4 week right coming up.
Yes, exciting.
Has anybody actually cared about which database they're using or the queries, whatever, when it comes to the items? I mean, like, for God's sake. Like, it's just like, just be quiet. Like, the
Yes,
battle
thoroughly
is,
don't care.
yeah, the battle is about user friction, the user journey. If this is technology to be used, like, imagine that if every time you had to use, like, let's say, Oracle or something, that you had to write that a database query inside the game in order to find an item. Who many would actually be playing that game? Like, nobody. And that is basically how they've been trying to brute force blockchain into games and trying to call it like a Web3 and expect success. It's like that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And yeah, it's just so
It.
that
That's good.
yeah. So those are like I would say that user friction is another angle like how we see it is like we think the technology has finally started to catch up. Where we are tech, and we see Immutable X, Passport, like everybody, more and more started to think about these things. And but when I had conversations with traditional game studios today, and I've had many of them, like we are more at traditional game expos, maybe Gamescom. I was just last week. I was at Nordic Games having a conversation with publishers and traditional game studios. And it's quite
Yeah.
interesting. Like, a lot of them, like, you'd think that the mass, like, what you face value, what you see in media, and also what you see at forums, people, like, gamers hate Web3. Game studios hate
Yes.
Web3.
Yes.
That is
Yes.
not true. That is so not true. If they knew how many of these studios, I'm not going to mention any of the names, I don't want to rat anyone out. If they only knew how many of these are actually investing money as we speak into Web3, just because they know they need to have some exposure to it, because it can potentially take off, and they do believe it. And I often have this conversation like, do you guys, everybody's talking about mobile games nowadays. I have this biggest rant and rave ever about this. Remember the first mobile games, Miko?
Yeah, of course.
Do you remember the technology called VAP?
I
WAP?
don't. Oh, WAP, WAP, yes, of course.
Yeah.
The web protocol, yes.
Do
The fake
you
internet on your
can you
phone. Yeah, I
honestly say
remember.
that they were great games?
They were tragically, embarrassingly bad. Yes.
Exactly. So I was having this conversation with a few executives from other like Web2 studios, and I just wanted to like spark their interest. Like, think about this. When that came, you could understand that this is something that can potentially disrupt the industry because you're not locked to a console or a PC, but you're actually mobile somewhere. And what can you do?
So you just said something that I really want to spotlight, right? Which is you said potential to disrupt the industry, right? Because the thing that's so interesting is if you go back to, and so this is a quote I enjoy, which is the idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? So like maybe it isn't your friend, maybe it's just your ally, right? But it's useful. It's a useful actor, right? So to me, when I study something like the reaction of fans of Ghost Recon to Ghost Recon NFT, right? The hatred is not actually at the NFTs themselves, because hating an NFT is like, it's like hating this pen, right? It's like, what it's a useless, ridiculous emotion, right? Like, it's like people aren't hating NFTs. They're hating suits and they're hating greed, right?
Yes.
Greed and suits, right? So the thing that becomes interesting is how the potential for the technology to actually destroy greed and suits, right? So if it has the potential to destroy greed and suits, so people's kind of like interpretation is so broken, because the interpretation is like, oh, they hate the NFTs, and it's like, oh, I really hate this pen. I just hope this pen will die. Like, what even is that? Like, that makes no sense, right? No. Why would a gamer hate an NFT? Like, it's like, it's like I hate TCP/IP, like whatever. It's just ridiculous, right?
It is ridiculous.
I hate the database, as you say, right? So the point is that we know they hate greed and we know they hate suits, yeah, because greed and suits have always ruined everything. So, like, you know, that's fine. Like, that's an okay thing to hate.
And the thing is that, like, there's also this culture, and I think that, like, I actually, like, one of the master thesis that I wrote back from university, my background is in information system management, and I wrote a thesis on culture, how culture impacts technology and how we look at things.
Amazing.
Thing is this, that if you look at blockchain, and where the culture, where that comes from, very much on the underground movement, right? And it's like, we don't want, yes, centralization, like we don't need the government, all this crap, like, yeah, okay,
yes, yes.
And then you think about like if you go to any gaming show, when it comes to, like, you know, Nordic Games or, you know, GDC or whatever, PAX East, Gamescom Tokyo, what you will see is that, like, how these people who are, like, who built this culture, I mean, they're very much also, like, they are non-suits. Let's put it like that. They're, like,
for real.
They're, like, they actually are closely integrated to, like, the culture of blockchain. And it's, like, how they want this, I come back to culture, like, how they want to use this technology. And then you have the blockchain greed that has happened. Oh. Nobody can tell me and look me in the eyes that with
that's
the
toxic
NFTs and opportunity and all this bullshit that was raised, like, and product that was started, wasn't like 90% was just greed. Completely greed. And
greed and without and suits, but still toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, toxic and greed. So I think that is the first wave. And we need to distance ourselves and to understand also that that's a history, and we humans, we learn. We see, like, how people, like, sometimes they bash me because I like the MiCA regulation. Like, I'm like, dude, it's like, grow up. Like, you need to have regulation. Like, it's a good thing. I understand that you want to have everything to decentralize, but I'm going to tell you one thing. As long as we have countries and governments, like, the endpoints will all be centralized. You can either play ball and you can sit on the sideline trying to, like, think about the world should be decentralized. Ain't going to happen like that. The center, how we use things, can be decentralized. A good example would be, like, how we consume something. Look at Netflix. The TV tableau when you and I, Mika, grew up. You have a son, I have a son. I tried to tell my kid, like, back in the days when dad grew up, like, you needed to catch the show you wanted to see on a specific TV channel, or you missed it.
It's over.
Or you had to record it, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, "Dad, your childhood sucks." I'm like, because it's like now everything is TV. So basically, we have decentralized how we can consume TV, right? And that's awesome. But, like, and that is a product that is out there that we can decentralize. So there's certain things that we can decentralize, but you cannot do it on everything. I'm sorry, it's a fantasy. And I think that that is something we need to really take into consideration when it comes to also how we're using this technology and our expectation for it. So that's a long rant and rave I have about.
So I would like to say this, is that one of the cool phrases in the world is this idea of progressive decentralization. And I think that the cool idea behind it is, to me, it connects almost with, like, Dr. King's arc of you know, freedom, this arc of history, right? Yeah. That it bends towards justice, right? So in a sense, like, to me, philosophically coming from open source software, I'm very much aligned as you are with better software. Right. So it's kind of like, can you make some better software? Because if you can, you should, and it would be great. Right. So it doesn't necessarily have as much of a maxi or fundamentalist type of a mindset. But the mm-hmm. thing that I think is so exciting to me is that, like, you know, people want the values of it, right? It's just yes. a question of time, right? So in a sense, like, being patient is a reasonable approach, you know, instead of being impatient. So I think a lot of people are overly impatient. So I think that's an issue. But I, you know, yeah. to me, I think we're going to get there. But you know, I'd love to kind of have you unpack kind of really, you know, where do you think the biggest industry impacts will be? Because I, you know, I share your enthusiasm for kind of the industry impact, right? Because in a sense, like, I went to GamesBeat. And, mm-hmm. You know, there was a guy on stage, I won't name any names, but his attitude was, we asked the gamers, okay. and the gamers didn't ask for NFTs. So mm-hmm. NFTs are, you know, dumb. And he said, he used the phrase bullshit bingo, right? So he basically is like, you shouldn't just say you're using Web3, you know, so that you can get funding. You know, so he was basically anti, right? Because yeah. the gamers hadn't asked him for NFT or Web3, right? But to me, I'm kind of like, well, you're such an industry insider. You know, I didn't say this out loud, but like my mind was, you know, that you're kind of more like part of the institution and you're part of the problem, right? Like you're, yeah. you're in some ways one of the suits now. Because yes. to me, I'm really interested in the revolutionary impact, right? So, you know, naming your studio Crypto Rogue, like, you know, and having some kind of tentacled creature, you know, as a logo. Yeah, absolutely, right? Which, you know, it fits the kind of, you know, Kraken logo, kind of yeah. like, you know, Chthonic kind of ethos, right? One of the exciting industry events to occur is, of course, we did see the release of Diablo 4 and, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people playing. You know, I heard some funny statistic, like they had already made $666 million in 10 days or something. It's sort of a funny number.
Yeah.
It's sort of a satanic number, you know, so it's a very, very entertaining. But, you know, so obviously it's, you know, successful release, you know, very big game, very... It's a hit game. People are buying it. You know, certainly some people are already grinding it. So, like, you know, mm-hmm. would love to get your thoughts.
My thoughts, it is a successful launch. Can't deny yep. that. Yep. I think that it is going to be interesting. I'm following this very closely, actually, like how they are going to apply further monetization in D4. Because there's also some monetization that hasn't taken or they haven't launched, from my understanding. I'm very curious to see how the community is going to react to that. And also, I know there's... I'm curious also to... We're following like their damage. The damage system has been, you know, changed from D3. So they're working with average damage now in D4. In a different way. That is exciting, looking at that. But I mean, what can you say? They spent a ton on marketing.
Yes.
I mean, that marketing sure. war chest is they spent a few dollars.
Yeah, I tweeted this billboard, and it was in New York City. And it was during the time when the Canadian wildfire had turned the entire sky this sort of orange, right? So mm-hmm. it's this crazy orange thing. And it was a Diablo billboard that said, New York City, welcome to hell. And then the whole thing was like, the whole sky was like dark orange. It was definitely like a very moody image, right? But I, you know, it speaks to what you were saying, right? Which is obviously they spent a lot. You know, they advertise everywhere, and you yeah. know, it's just an amazing striking industry event.
I had somebody ask me, like, kind of like in the sense that they're expecting me to want D4 to fail, to be like a flop.
Oh,
and say like, I'm like, no, I'm like, for us building an action RPG game, okay, just to use like a reference here is like Diablo and that IP from Blizzard is the tide, right? And if
Yeah.
tide rises and the sheer volume of marketing being spent in that genre game, we want them to succeed.
Yeah, no question.
The same with Path of Exile 2 coming out. I mean, I wish Chris and his team at Grindiger Games, I generally want them to be successful and succeed. There's no animosity. Like you don't work in this way. Like,
Sure.
I hope they fail. No, I mean, like, I hope they really kick ass. And so more people look into this genre, because that is, for us, launching into that environment is, it's just a positive thing, right? And our game
Yeah.
coming out next year. So yeah,
Yeah, for
makes.
sure. For sure. So I guess what I'd love for you to do is kind of give us some of the really interesting design decisions and contrasts, particularly with these games that everybody knows really well.
If you're referring to like design decisions from our own game or
Yes.
from, yeah,
Yeah, not ours.
well, I think that if you look at this simple core loop of these games, which is, let's break down Diablo as a core loop. I mean, you have an
Yes.
encampment, you take a quest, you go to a dungeon, you kill mobs, you loot, you go back. Sell items, store some items in stash tab, rinse, repeat. That is the core loop. That's a 50-minute core loop in the game, right? So, like, our design principle, excuse me, is not any difference. Like, that's what we're focusing on, and it's all about item progression. But I think where things start to change and what's different is, like, there's these nuances. And I think, for example, I think customization of a character is important. Yes, as much
Yeah.
as item progression is important. But in this case, let's say you're facing a boss. A boss using Shield Bash as a skill. And that skill can actually, if you kill the boss, the skill can be dropped as a as
Oh.
an item.
Wow.
And that has a like a procedural generated, like if it's the rarity of it.
Yeah.
So you can have, like, just common skill level on this, or it's a rare or a legendary. And that means how much you can further evolve that skill. So you're able to sync skill points. And in this game, we're using crystals to contribute towards that skill increasement. So it's
Yeah.
like a currency for you to use inside the game, like skill points, to evolve your skill. So that will give you different kind of building blocks to create your character with these different skills. And we're trying to make them in such a way that, just as in Path of Exile, like, you could actually, certain classes will have a natural progression where they're stronger in their natural domain, but you can still use this. Let's say that you are a knight in our game, so that's a one class, but you can still use ranged combat as, let's say, rifles or shotguns in this world. So it's just an example. Like, then you can focus on that, even though those weapon types would naturally be more for the class called Gunner in our game. But so it's these nuances makes it in from a game design exciting. We think that the play is something that they will also be excited about. And I think there's also this focus on where we're applying our procedural generated mechanic in our game. With that, I mean is that every time you go into a dungeon, that dungeon is not necessarily looking the same. So there's a replayability for you as a player. So it's not just about the items that you're carrying or the monster that you're facing that are different from time to time as you go into a dungeon, but the environment can look different also. We're of course working with static dungeons, but I think this is important for you to have in a game. So if you look at late game, we're going to have a system called mapping, so you can find different items in the game, map pieces in the game. Right, and these map pieces merged together will create you a new dungeon, and that can be played. So I think these are like some nuances to some of them already exist, but then you use those mechanics that you know works, and then you are able to tweak them a bit to make them, you know, fresh and exciting.
Yeah, if I understand the kind of mechanics of sort of the crystal slash skill point investment, right, then in a way, like, I really like it from a narrative perspective, right? Because one of the things that I think is so essential within gaming is for things to make sense, right? Now, because coherence is so important. It's a inherently deep part of the experience of
Yes.
gaming, right? Which is that every time something happens in the game, even if it's something very disappointing, right? You just have to have this feeling of like, of course it is so, right?
Yes.
And obviously, if it's something bad has happened, right, then you can say, well, I didn't play well, and of course this is so, right? So, like, this sense of fairness or justice or. And so to me, one of the things I really like about this narrative quality of like dropping powers or capabilities like a shield bash or this type of thing is that when the player subsequently uses the skill, the thing that's very interesting is that they've actually been presented with sort of a graphical, sort of a pinnacle representation of what that looks like when it's deployed by a boss, right? So in a
Yes.
sense, like, they have kind of almost the soul of the boss that is embedded within their every character action, right? So in a sense, when you think about the narrative quality, right, like, obviously you could kind of think about it narratively as like the character learned how powerful this ability could be by encountering it, in the wild, right? In this oppositional
Yes.
conflict, right? And then by learning that, of course, they may not have mastered it, right? But they may have a sense of how the potential of such an action,
That
right?
is
And then
exactly the case.
they need to kind of further fill experience towards that to kind of attain the same level of mastery or like power. But to me, from a player perspective, like, it's very invigorating or exciting, right? Because when I'm performing this action, I'm imagining the full power. Like, I'm imagining the power that, the player experienced when they saw the boss, do this mechanic, right? So that feels very connected. It feels very like sensible, and it feels very like of course it is so, right? So
Yeah,
that's a very nice mechanic.
I think that it's like that's what we're trying to achieve, the excitement of the boss fights has to be exciting. Like
Yes.
it has to, right? And when
Yeah.
you let's it doesn't matter what you're doing, if it's like, you know, let's say, as for argument's sake, let's say it's like flame wall that is being used as a skill, like, yeah, and it's like something really massive that is like even better if you died to that freaking skill from a boss. Then it's like so frustrating, right? And then you manage to overcome this and win, and that skill is dropped. Let's say that you're able to use that later, but it's not as powerful, obviously, because it's the beginning
For
of it.
sure. For
But then you
sure.
know what it could potentially do, and once you reach that level as a player, you will recognize back from where you're fighting that boss. Now you're using it against minions, and it's just dying in hordes. That is satisfying.
Yeah, I think to me, the thing that's exciting about this idea of bosses and abilities and all of these things is it kind of harkens back to sort of this entire sense of the unknown, right? And the fear of the unknown, right? So that's part of what I think adds a dimension of excitement, right? So when you look at a movie like Cloverfield, or even go all the way back to the original Godzilla or monster movie, right? Like, one of the things that happens throughout the plot of such a movie is that you suddenly see the unveiling of new powers, right? So you'll see something like the introduction of like the Godzilla atomic breath weapon, which previously hadn't been seen, right? But then when you see it, like, the experience of the viewer is this sort of sinking feeling, right? Of like, oh wow, like, they can do this now, right? So it's really, so that adds a layer of like shock value to this kind of experience, right? Because in a way, when we encounter the unknown and we have a fear of the unknown, right, this that is kind of this unpacking of like, what now, what next, right? What is this? And I think the thing that I really like about what you're describing is you're describing this sense of control over the elements.
Yes.
Right? In the sense that, like, you know, we are afraid and we see the power and the power is used against us, right? And eventually we kind of control the power, right? Even in this super limited way, right? Even if it's just that you can make now, you can light a cigarette with this firewall, you know, like, yeah. It's just this very, very inkling of this, like, I think I know how this works now, right? You know, and obviously there's this feeling, you know, so to me, like, it's a much deeper instantiation of something, you know, if you go back to something like Dungeons and Dragons, right? Mm-hmm. This is very coarsely grained construct of, like, leveling and experience, right? But it's very, very unidimensional and very kind of, you know, when we think about human experience, like, human experience is closer to what you're describing, right? Which is you see a specific thing and then you learn about that thing and then you get better at that, right? So I think it's a really much more kind of intuitive feeling of progression. So it feels good.
One thing I'm excited about is to see once Narramoons is launched. So what we're working with from a storytelling or storyline perspective is that the world of Narramoons, there was a post-apocalyptic event. Something happened. And the surface was scorched, and it's like, these were like 900 years ago this happened. So when the players start the storyline, something bad has happened hundreds of years ago. And what exactly happened hasn't really been revealed to the players.
Yeah.
But there is this council that is harnessing this knowledge about what happened in the past, right? And it's like this, so this mix between technology and medieval world, so it's like this steampunk apocalyptic world. And you as a player, you encounter more like high-tech devices that is not really in sync with the time, right? In
yes.
the current era.
Yes.
During the storyline, without disclosing too much, but it's that event that is called in the world of Narramoons the Nexus will then happen again. That is the retention mechanic built inside this world. So every 3 months, everything is resetted and the economy is resetted. But the things that are not resetted in our world is... you as a player are able to find certain items that are more powerful. Let's say that you find a rare or legendary item that has dormanted stats. You can still equip them. Let's say it's an armor. Okay, so Miku, you find this armor, legendary armor that has dormanted stats. Then you go to an armor smith where you're using crystals because the crystals has this magical ether inside them to unleash these dormanted stats. Now, these items are then called ethereals. We're never talking about NFTs or blockchain in our game.
Sure.
So, and what has happened now is that item is now on chain, right? But as yep. a player, you don't experience that. You know, you're not going outside the game. It's just you're crafting it. And so there you have the ethereal item. These are items are being carried between seasons. But that means that this new reset, this new world, season 2, will have new zones. Being launched, so there's something new for players to experience, but certain of these items are not going to drop again. Mm. So there's like this legacy of the previous seasons, the previous apocalyptic event that's been carried over between these different seasons. That I'm excited to see, like, once we get the game to be launched and how players are experiencing this and how player will use this in a barter economy. Outside the game to see, like, okay, wait a minute, like, this was something that was in the first season. This is like a total OG item, and they start becoming like this legacy, a legend about some of these items as the game progression. Yeah,
I definitely like the overall landscape, the mythology, the construct. You definitely had me at apocalyptic, you know, because I'm definitely a big fan of, obviously, apocalyptic fiction.
Yeah.
That has a tendency to kind of pull into sort of the survival type genres, you know. So, but I definitely think there's a ton of, like, great space available for apocalyptic scenarios. I think the other dimension that you're drawing forward that I think is very contemporary is, you know, something where you have kind of this complex or mixed tech base, right? So like if you look in like the Riot Games Runeterra universe, yep. right? You definitely see the you know this kind of mixed. Obviously, you have basic swords and sorcery, right? But then on top, you actually have layers, right? So you have things like Hextech and Chemtech, which are both kind of like this sort of very proto types of technologies, right? But they can really manifest in these quite advanced, you know, things like map teleportation style capabilities or these kind of very mystical capabilities, right? But yeah. they're framed in the kind of design language of technology, you know, so it creates a much bigger, kind of more metaversal palette for entertainment, right? And I think Riot has definitely shown quite a lot of leadership in terms of how they've, you know, manifested this. So yeah. I think it's exciting to see.
And I think also as players are experiencing this world because of this reoccurring event, that's actually where the crystals originated from, this event. And they're like the crystals, like they're more like a battery that is being used because of its power. So it's wrong to say like currency inside the game, but it's not a currency. It's more like a battery power that they can charge up their, you know, skills or certain items. And I think that's it's going to be. Can't wait to launch the game. Let's put it like that.
Yeah.
So like, and also like a lot of the play testing they've done in-house has been very exciting. It's been a lot of fun. Feedback, both, I mean, there's both always going to be good and negative feedback, but overall it's been very positive and exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's the thing that I'm also excited about, the way you're thinking about this too, is that I'm really thinking about IP. You know, so the thing that I think is exciting about IP, you know, because the context of this is really the idea of blockchain technology as a combination of things, but one of them is kind of digitally permanent objects, right, that exist in a kind of pure neutral internet format, right, not inside of any kind of database of ownership, right? And so I think that the idea of durable IP becomes kind of this history creation and storytelling fabric, right? So to me, the thing that happens is that, you know, the IP itself can have an exceedingly long lifetime that's really only limited by the devotion of the community, right? That the community can make the IP last as long as it wants to, and you know, and it can create entertainment, right? So I mean, I'm using the term entertainment very broadly, right? Like they can make fan fiction, or entertainment is entertainment. Like it doesn't have to be games, or but they could certainly expand on the story, right? So that the depth of the story, the depth of the universe, and the rules of the universe become kind of really, really the key, right? Because you're just really providing an experience of this universe.
Yeah.
You know, and helping people understand how it works, right? Yeah. And once they understand how the universe works, they can maybe go on to innovate and create more fun.
Yeah, and I think that if you look at something that excites me, if what's it called again? The studio behind Final Fantasy, I've completely forgot their name. Square Enix.
Yeah, Square Enix, sure.
And their CEO coming out, like, I mean, they're really doubling down on this technology, like, and with games. And how listening to him talk about how they see that with blockchains, like, how that can be used as the future of user-generated content, right? And that is exciting thought. I think that this new wave, the second wave of games using this technology will hit much, much closer to where the technology should have been in the first place in the intersection with a game, which is something that the user owns the content, but like not as a like a gateway in order for you to get into the game, but out of the content that exists in the game that are then being owned by the players outside the game, and then creating this opportunity to for this item to be traded among friends, and where we can then see the business model, free to play and game as a service, is being extended. And that's where I think we will see the second wave of this game coming.
I do greatly appreciate you evoking the Final Fantasy franchise and Square Enix in this context, right? Because I do think that the idea of durable IP, and by the way, the CEO that I think is aforementioned actually was sent packing, so there's a new CEO at Square Enix. But I would say that that's not it. Right now, Japan is very hot on blockchain, and and I think there's a lot of great activity happening there. But I would say that the reason why I appreciate this is that Japan is home to many incredibly durable global IP franchises that are kind of multi-generational. And the thing that's incredible about kind of Japan IP is that it has an incredibly durable quality, right? So I mean, recently Super Mario movie, like $1 billion box office for a film, by the way, that the critics panned. The critics hated it. So you can't find an article online that says this is a good movie, right? And so it's basically like all you can find are articles saying this is a terrible movie, and there's a $1 billion box office. So it's, it to me, like, that is definitely a salute to gamer centricity. I watched the trailer, it's filled with like gamer Easter eggs, right? So it's really just this kind of like dominance of, a player-centric transmedia and this kind of emergence. If you look at something like Netflix Arcane, the reason why it's player-centric is you can be watching a TV show or a movie, and you actually know what buttons are being pressed on the controller, right? So if Jinx on the screen is firing Super Mega Death Rocket, you're pressing R, right? And if you see Mario doing fast running in the movie, it's a B dash, right? So you that's gamer centricity, right? Like that is absolutely slavishly Easter egging gamers, and that's where we're going, right? Like I think the game, the sort of IP exploitation era is over, right? I think on stage at Gamesbeat, we had this wonderful kind of senior executive at a very large game company, I won't name names, who said that IP is double-edged. And the thing that they said was double, and this was music to my ears, right? Which is that, the history of big game IP has been kind of a history of exploitation, right? So this executive basically said it's double-edged because you have to bring in new users, but you also have to please the old fans of the IP, right? And that's great, right? That means that the internet is actually now performing its function, which is that if you've trampled on the childhood memories and the hearts of like fans of an IP, like you deserve what you get, right? And so for a very, very senior game company executive to be talking about kind of respect, right? Like if you look at something like Lord of the Rings, Jeff Bezos threw $1 billion into the Second Age, right? And when the initial photographs of like the characters like young Elrond came out, the fans were trying to read the elvish embroidery on his clothing. Like it was just so like, slavishly devotional, which I think is good, right? Like that's where we need to go.
But I couldn't agree more. And if you look looping back to what you mentioned about Mario, I mean, I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, right? And have we played Mario Kart? Of course. That's a great times hanging out on weekend, playing together. I know you play games with your son as well,
Yes.
and when. Because Mario Kart was something that was very enjoyable, very easy. Like even when they were like, 4 or 5 year olds, they could still play that game.
Yes.
And for them, of course, when then a movie like Mario coming out, they don't care about the critics. Like they couldn't care
Of
less. Like
course
look,
not. No.
seriously, they it's the character they recognize, end of story, and they want to go and see it. And you as a dad, obviously you're going to go and see it with them because you're going to have a good time together. And it's a mix of those like memories that you have together with this IP. And the critics be damned. They could we don't care. Seriously, we do not care at from that angle about the movie
But
critics.
I want to draw forth like what makes this sort of so supreme in this kind of fundamentally interactive environment, right? Which is when you really look at what Nintendo has cared for and what the Mario franchise has cared for, like they've cared for your younger sibling, right? Or the younger child, right? In the sense that when he, you know, this child gets further and further behind in the race, right? Like suddenly he's like Bullet Bill and he's like flying forward and beating everyone, right? So like there's just these very thoughtful like scaffolds that like really understand this idea of a family, right? And they understand the idea of, right? So if you go all the way back to the very beginning of Nintendo, right? There was this concept of personal computing, right, which was called in Japan, it was called Pasokon. Paso is personal computing, Pasokon, right? And the console that Nintendo launched was called Famicom, family computer, right?
What's that?
So
I didn't know that.
that was
Interesting.
the original Nintendo. In Japan, the release, it was called Famicom, right,
Huh.
which is the family computer, right? So in a sense, this gestalt is deep. It's very, very old and deep, right? Like that their mindset is really about these familial relationships and memories, right? Which is just so to me, like that's $1 billion right there. Like that's like, you know, like Disney loves to have their parents and the kids both be entertained in the same movie. And it's like, you know, this is really Nintendo asserting that they understand this, that they are able to deliver, right? So I think it's a really I don't know, it's a great moment. They're making a historical grab for this kind of like four quadrant IP. I think they're still a little weak on the female gamer side, but I do think that, you know, the fact that Luigi is captured and not Peach is good for their franchise. Like I think they're getting some girl gamers, like they're fleshing out their IP.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this upcoming year. Let's say moving into 2024, and when it comes to games and with this technology of Web3, do you think like now with you know this fallout with SEC and so on? Like I see it like this. Like I see US doing like the scorched earth tactics that like Russian did way back in warfare, like burn everything, try to burn everything to the ground, and then we rebuild and have like a you know a framework of regulation there in place. But and I'm bringing this up because I'm curious to hear your thoughts about how you see like the future with games here and with this technology moving forward. And with this, I mean, we hear about bigger studios doing this more like not, they don't officially mention that they're working with this, the applying Web3, because they don't want to set off their community, but they're working in the background. And just curious to hear your thoughts
Yeah, I
here.
mean, the depth of this technology is hard to underestimate, right? So, for example, you know, in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley here, you know, we have home to two fairly famous and rightly so research universities, UC Berkeley, and then, of course, Stanford, right? So, if you go to Berkeley and Stanford, I mean, it isn't everyone, of course, but like the depth of research in mathematics and cryptography and indeed in blockchain is very, very substantial. The investment is very, very substantial, right? So I think people are very, I think if you look at it very superficially and you know you've bought into some kind of a token scam and they ran away with your money, like I think there is this kind of very superficial feeling of like, oh, it's all bad, right? But like when you get to the kind of depths of what's happening from the perspective of technology design and you know, decentralized cryptography, fully homomorphic encryption, you know, zero knowledge proofs, of course, and like multi-party computation, you know, threshold cryptography. There's just these like absolutely fundamental components and building blocks for the future, right? And I think as you start to inject things like AI into Web 2,
Mm-hmm.
you pretty much becomes obvious that the internet isn't going to survive in its current incarnation, right? That we can't continue forward blithely as we are, and we actually need cryptography, and we need the deeper technological primitives and solutions that are being formed today, you know, within things like research and academia, right? So, like, I guess the thing that's incredible about this is that it is an inexorable and irresistible change. And I don't think people appreciate how deep it is, right? Like, you know, you can go hang out with, you know, Don Song in Berkeley or Dan Bonet at Stanford, and you can learn a heck of a lot. You know, like these are very, very foundational research to advance the state of humanity, right? So, like, you know, so I would say that the regulators are taking a political posture, but I think to me they may prevail over Binance, which kind of had what I call a risk it to get the biscuit strategy. But it feels like Coinbase is going to prevail, right? Like EOS demonstrated, they just turned around. You know, EOS hired Baker Marquardt, a great law firm. You know, they brought the SEC to heel. They paid a $24 million fine in a form of a settlement after raising $4 billion in an ICO, right? So, like, you know, this is the ultimate. They didn't even slap the wrist, right? It was really just a pinky knuckle. Like, it was definitely nothing, right? So, like, what I think the object lesson there is that the cost of bringing the SEC to heel is sub $10 million. So Coinbase, it can do this until they're blue in the face. Like, Coinbase can basically do this all day. They have the budget. They can just, and so, and their goal, their publicly stated goal is not to have a settlement, right? The publicly stated goal of Coinbase is, no, you are not suing us. We are suing you. Like, we are suing the SEC, and we intend to prevail in order to create a legal precedent. Right. They want to create they want the judge to say, like, you don't get to do this anymore. These things are now declared as non-securities. You know, maybe some of them will be declared as securities. Right. It's definitely going to be a protracted fight. So it may take some years. But I think that the upshot is that, you know, it's all part of this kind of inexorable rise of Internet. Right. This is all Internet. So, like, I think it's very irresistible. It's very international also, by the way. And if you look at certain countries like the UK, you know, Rishi Sunak has opened a 16Z office in UK, and, you know, they're very, very excited about crypto things. And you can see that he's on record saying that Web3, that he wants the UK to be the leading country for Web3, right? And then if you go to Japan, you see, you know, Kishida-san, the prime minister there, who is like keynoting a Web3 conference of all things, right? So, like, you know, Japan is another country where you're seeing, like, so obviously, you know, there's a historical kind of, like, attraction to looking at the United States. But I think that, like, you know, the numbers aren't really there anymore, right? Yeah. Like, if you look at the, you know, more than 50% of the world sits in a circle that covers maybe China and India and a few other countries, right? So, like, you know, it's definitely the center of gravity has shifted. And, you know, I think the U.S. has sort of a really interesting market, but it's definitely not the it's not the only one.
No, definitely not. And I think I asked the question because it's just interesting to hear your point of view and your thoughts. And also, like, how that looking with games in the future. I think that more and more some will quickly get scared because what they see with SEC, and they're still listening to, like, the US market is like as it's something that is all ruling, which it's not, right? And I just think that it just proved that I'm actually very thankful. Very thankful that we're a European company and in the European Union, and we have the MiCA regulation, right?
Yes.
It is a framework that you can actually, so, like, you know what to, like, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And I think that more game studios will feel more comfortable using this technology. And I'm talking about, like, this old Web2 game studios. And had several conversations with them during, like, Nordic Games. And from what I'm hearing is that more and more they're looking into this technology. They see that there's starting to be a way for this to be applied where it makes sense. Like, I think so many were scared away after, like, the past bull run because that was just so weird to them. It's like they couldn't resonate.
Nonsense.
Yeah. But now I think it's they're feeling like getting more clarity. And I think that even though there might be, call it a bear market or whatever you want to call it, but like the macroeconomy is not awesome. Let's put it like that.
So here's the thing, is that there are always gray areas and there are always limits, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I think people have this idea that the SEC is the U.S. government, right? And that the U.S. government is like all powerful. And it's just very, very ridiculous. Like, the SEC is 1% of the size of Goldman Sachs, and it has the job of regulating Goldman Sachs, among other things, right? Not just crypto, right? So, like, my point is that there are extreme limits. So if you look at something like the Howey test, right, you know, late 1930s, this kind of like funny little legal precedent, right, that effectively defines what is and isn't a security, right? Imagine this, right? Imagine that you're Meta Kovan and you've bought this $69 million Beeple art, right? So the question becomes this, right, which is you bought the Beeple art, but here's the funny thing is Beeple is a living artist. Right. So people could produce more art, which he's doing. Right. Mm-hmm. And he's doing this wonderful. He's created a beautiful facility in Charleston, you know, South Carolina. And he's building more and more art. Right. And the idea becomes this is should Meta Kovan be hoping that people creates an even more famous art and that he creates even more success and makes even a bigger name? And then and what would happen to the price of the art that he bought? The price of the art would go up, right?
Yep.
Based on the work of this a centralized figure. So it's sort of like, oh, is that a security? Is that art a security now? So is all art a security? I mean, it's only a security if the artist is still alive and capable of building more art, right?
Yep.
So then it's a security, right? So I guess what I'm really pushing is I'm basically like, the limit is actually just resources, right? Which is that the SEC could potentially go out to the edge of the internet and say this NFT is a security, this Bored Ape is a security, but they just don't have the money. Like they don't have the attention, they don't have the staff, they're not going to because they can't.
Yeah.
Basically that's the answer.
My take on it as a that's a good take on it. But I think also like my background from the gambling industry, I see the similarity with what's happening right now with how US acted with online gambling and shut everything down. I remember the Black Friday, was it 2007, when they completely banned everything, you know, and there was this, you know, voice about this being the end of online gambling because US shut down. And I'm like, nah, have you ever visited Vegas? Who is generating the turnover? I mean, it's coming from Asia. Let's put it that way. And there's a lot of Westerners that don't even understand how insanely big Macau is. It's three times the size of Vegas in terms of turnover. So it's massive, but probably bigger by now. But anyway, this is data data that goes back like 10 years when I talk about 3x size. But the thing is that everything went very well, even US shutting down, because the rest of the world just continued, looked at US and said, like, what are you guys doing? Okay, stay over there. We're just going to continue down this path, and you can catch up once you realize that that is a mistake, basically.
Well, I like the metaphor. I think it's very appropriate. I'm actually reading a book by Herman Nerula, who is founded Improbable, which is sort of a metaverse VR company. It's called Virtual Societies, right? And he asked this question of who built the pyramids of Egypt and why did they build the pyramids, right? And his thesis is that they built it based on virtual reality, right? And so he's not talking about aliens with VR headsets, right? What he's talking about is he's talking about the human ability to imagine a world that's better than this world, and that they're valuing the contents of that world more than they're valuing the contents of this world. So the question is, what is that world? So if you go back to ancient Egypt, it's a world with like animal-headed gods, right? And it's a world. So they created this story, and the evidence that they valued the story is they built these giant pyramids, right? So it's sort of this, I think it's a very incontrovertible evidence that they valued these narratives, right? Because who would do such a thing, right? It seems insane, right? And it's sort of like, clearly they bought into their own stories, and clearly they were very, very passionate about the value of those stories. And we have this physical evidence of the pyramids, right? So the funny part is if you go to Vegas and you look at the pyramids there, like Luxor.
Yes.
You know, you're like, what is the metaverse that built this? Right. And it's, you know, to me, what is the passion and what is the kind of like belief? Right. And it's clear, right? The belief and the passion is that these kind of chance games have this kind of extremely deep root within kind of the human psyche, right? So that when you just go there and you just look at all the buildings, all the exotic buildings, right? They have incredible, you know, Eiffel Tower, right? It's goofy, right? Like, yes. You know, Las Vegas is goofy.
It is.
But it's also just, there's something weirdly impressive about it. Right? It's hard to compare with something like the Great Pyramids, but like, you know, but there's still something behind it, obviously, right? Yeah. And whatever's behind it is like, it's very powerful and real, right? So, you know, I think to me, I'm making the same point, right? Which is if you go to these temples like Berkeley and Stanford, and you look at the high priests of cryptography, and you look at, they're creating a story and they're creating a virtual world. And if you look at the number of ultra, ultra competitive students that are sitting there, like writing down everything that these high priests are saying, and you know, like, this is a virtual world, right? This is a metaverse, and it is the metaverse of the blockchain. And these, you know, so we are going to get our version of the pyramids, right? Which is basically what I would call Web3. Like, you know, we're going to have, like, in our hands, the evidence that these stories that we're telling ourselves.
I've never heard a spin before, but I'll buy into that. Web3 being our generation's, you know.
It's our pyramids.
Pyramids, yes.
Yeah, no, if you go sit in on any of these like lectures in cryptography, like the amount of attention, the amount of intelligence, the amount of passion, it's you'll feel it. And this will not be discarded. Like the root is super deep, right? Like, it may be that the storm is knocked over the tree, or the branches are broken, or this, you know, but the root is just goes to the center of the earth. Like, this is a really strong tree, you know, and that's kind of why I persist in the belief, right? Which is that these technologies are fundamental, and you know, they're absolutely supremely powerful and mathematical. So, you know, I think we're definitely going to see this stuff wind its way into you know, people's lives.
Yeah, and I think also we're just scratching the surface how much this will impact our life when it comes to blockchain. I think that I mean you were there when the internet came, you know, the first steps of internet era. Yeah, and it was exciting, and I think it was like, for me, internet back then was just the opportunity to play a multi-user dungeon, text-based, in that world, and having fun. And later it was, you know, able to play something online was just super exciting. I remember playing Team Fortress. But then little could I ever imagine that internet would decentralize how we consume TV. Because me trying to explain to my kids that when dad grew up, there was this, I think you call it, what do you call it in English, like TV tableau, like where it's like, you know, when
TV guide,
yes. So like at 3 p.m. there's a show or whatever, like, yeah, in the morning, like this kids cartoon at 8 a.m. And if you didn't catch it at that time, unless you recorded it at the VHR or VHS or like you missed it. And I'm like, what, dad? That sounds like a horrible childhood. I'm like, you guys are spoiled.
Yeah.
You guys are spoiled.
So you had to dig a ditch. You had to you know, work in the coal mine.
Yeah, exactly. So here they are, like TV on demand, like was completely unheard of. To decentralize how we consume TV, and I think that is just like a good example to be humble about what this new technology can actually potentially disrupt in how we're using and consuming something, or in our case, my company building an action RPG game. It's going to be super exciting because we feel like we are in this first stumbling step of this technology together with a game. We're trying to have a very humble approach about it, making sure that it's compliant, like following the MiCA regulation and so on. So there's certain limitations, like, but we're not doing things everything on chain. We're not doing everything on chain. It's like just
For sure.
some element of it, and then this will
Yep.
gradually grow to something much, much bigger. You know, who knows what how games will be consumed with blockchain in mind in, 10 years from now. But yeah.
Yeah, but we very, very excited about this future. I think to me, the thing that happens is, as a species, we have this tremendous technology where we can actually begin to convert matter directly into energy. It's called fusion energy, right? And the question that arises for me is, there's incredible companies like Commonwealth Fusion that are making incredible progress towards sustainable fusion reactors, right? So the thing that happens when AI comes takes away a lot of people's jobs, right? And when, but the thing that would traditionally happen under those circumstances would be war. But what happens if there's abundance? What happens if we have plenty of energy, right? So now if we have plenty of energy, we can desalinate the ocean, we can have plenty of water, right? And now we can do really unbelievable things. Like we can start doing things like on ocean vertical farming, right? So we can start, right? And we don't necessarily need the sun because we harness the power of the sun locally. So we can create grow lamps and we can create these plant structures that grow food, right? So now we have abundant food, right? So like, to me, if we have a world like this, entertainment becomes supreme, right? So in a way, like these are the hopes, right? And entertainment becomes what it has always really been as an industry, right? But as an industry, it becomes sort of a dominant industry, right? It becomes this very, very powerful industry. And you're seeing the tech giants believe in this future, right? With the $8 billion acquisition of MGM by Amazon is a bet in this future, right? The acquisition of Activision Blizzard by Microsoft is a bet in this future. And do you think Satya Nadella knows anything about AI and the impact AI will make on society? Like, he is the godfather of OpenAI, right? So, like, to me, I think the lines are drawn, and I do think that I do pin my hopes on the emergence of like abundant clean energy, which will help make the world a lot more abundant and peaceful, right? So, on behalf of our children, we'd love to see such a thing. But like, if you kind of draw all the lines forward from there, entertainment becomes sort of one of the largest activities of humanity, right? And
And
so, to me, it's
hopefully good entertainment, so we don't see like these scenarios that what's that Running Man? Remember that movie?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of bread and circuses, right? Which is this kind of idea of like if you go back to the ancient Rome, right? There's gladiators, right? So it's combat to the death, right? So it is this kind of very dark kind of form of entertainment, right? So to me, like obviously having kind of virtuous entertainment and but I to me like if you are able to get to a state where civilization has abundant energy, that's a tremendous pivot point for the species, and I do think that that's the tipping variable between whether we have sort of a more utopian or more dystopian final state, and I think to me, like many of the complaints about cryptocurrencies really do have to do with the mentality of scarcity, and this kind of like dystopian kind of hacker world, which is well documented in cyberpunk fiction by writers like William Gibson, right? Where you have these mega corporations and then you have these pseudo governments and then you have these hacker guilds that are maybe as rich as governments. So it's definitely like an incredibly dark and dystopian future, right? But like, we don't have to have that, right?
No.
Like, I think there are wonderful opportunities and scenarios under which we tilt towards more financial abundance, capability, and, you know, and really energy. So, you know, I just think, just wanted to close on that note. I just feel like, you know, we're both parents. We're thinking about the future. We're looking at entertainment, and, you know, we're definitely, you know, trying to make the world a better place. So, you know, I think, for our kids.
I couldn't agree more. That's a good closing note.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's been a very super pleasure talking to you, Mikko. Enjoyable. Very enjoyable.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
And also, your show, Mikko Bits. You bring interesting topic to life.
Oh, thank you so much.